Good morning, everyone. So today we are going to be taking a look at three different things as it relates to Leviticus chapter 20. And it's important to understand that as we look at Leviticus 20, where are we? We're in the desert. We're given the Mosaic covenant, and Israel has escaped Egypt. They're in the desert, and they're later on going to be entering the promised land to develop their own country, and they're receiving God's guidance on what he wants them to do and what that should look like. And Leviticus is part of the law and part of the sacrificial system and other instruction on what God wanted them to be as far as a people that would worship him. What's really important to understand is there's vast differences between Israel in this time, Jesus's day and what the government looked like that day and what the government looks like today. And, you know, I'm speaking from America, so I'm going to be talking a little bit about America in this podcast. Now, in the desert right now, after they escaped Egypt and before they come to take over the promised land, they have what's called a theocracy. Essentially, they are under God's head. Moses is a figure of that representation, but ultimately God's teaching them how to be a people that are going to worship him and follow and obey his law. And God's laws are essentially the government's laws. I mean, they're one and the same. And they are supposed to worship God and him only. It's a very unique government at this time. Really, the government is run by Moses and the priests, and they are to worship and obey God. And what we're going to see is when God set up this theocracy, he didn't want them to do anything that dishonored him or that worshiped other gods, and the penalties were very significant. So let's take a look at Leviticus 20, and then we're going to go into a conversation of what this looked like in Jesus's day, and then what this looks like in America, both at its founding and in today. All right, here we go. So verse 1, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, you shall also say to the sons of Israel, any man from the sons of Israel or from the aliens sojourning in Israel, meaning if other people came to reside in Israel who were not one of those who came out of Egypt, who gives any of his offspring to Molech, a false god, shall surely be put to death. The people of the land shall stone him with stones. So in this theocracy, the only worship that was allowed was worship of God. The Jewish God, Yahweh, who, you know, is our triune God, from whom, you know, Jesus is part of that triune God in the New Testament today. But you could not worship any other God. You had to worship, if you were going to be part of Israel, you had to worship him or him only. Or if you worshiped anything else, you could be stoned. I will also set my face against that man and will cut him off from among his people because he has given some of his offspring to Molech so as to defile my sanctuary and to profane my holy name. If the people of the land, however, should ever disregard that man when he gives any of his offspring to Molech so as not to put him to death, then I myself will set my face against the man and against his family, and I will cut off from among their people both him and all those who play the harlot after him, by playing the harlot after Molech. And you know, it was required that Israel would take care of this and kill this man if he worshiped another god. So, you know, they needed to not only not worship Molech, but also if someone else did, they needed to put out this punishment upon this person. Otherwise, they were going to be punished. This was a theocracy. Listen, when God created the world, he wanted the world to honor and worship him, and he knew that that would be best. He knew that if they start worshiping false gods, where is it going to go? How messed up is it going to be? And all of a sudden, they're going to disown him and not follow him and get involved in all kinds of sin and dysfunction. So God was trying to protect them to live holy lives and to honor him. He's the creator of it all. And he's like, listen, this is what we need to do is we need, you guys need to follow me and my teaching. As for the person who turns to mediums and to spiritists to play the harlot after them, I will also set my face against that person and will cut him off from among the people. You shall consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am the Lord your God. You shall keep my statutes and practice them. I am the Lord who sanctifies you. God is saying it's going to be best for you if you honor me. If there is anyone who curses his father or mother, he shall surely be put to death. He has cursed his father or his mother. His blood guiltiness is upon him. And wow, what a strong word there. You know, we're supposed to honor our father and our mother. I wonder what God would say if the father was sexually abusing or abusing the children. I'm sensing from God there could be an exception when someone's a total bastard like that. But other than that, you are supposed to honor your father and mother. If there is a man who commits adultery with another man's wife, one who commits adultery with his friend's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. God was very serious about people following his ways. If there is a man who lies with his father's wife, he has uncovered his father's nakedness, both of them shall surely be put to death. Their blood guiltiness is upon them. If there is a man who lies with his daughter-in-law, both of them shall surely be put to death. They have committed incest. Their blood guilt is upon them. I tell you what, would you want to do one of these things that was wrong when you knew you could be killed for it? I mean, you should want to do it because you want to honor God and not do what God would not want. But, you know, these swift penalties would definitely ensure that people would be a lot less likely to do these things. If there is a man who lies with a male as those who lie with a woman, back to homosexuality, both of them have committed a detestable act, they shall surely be put to death. I mean, we've made that issue crystal clear. You can listen to my teaching on Leviticus 18 if you want to hear more of a thorough analysis of Old and New Testament regarding that issue. Their blood guiltiness is upon them. That's for the homosexuality. If there is a man who marries a woman and her mother, it is immorality. Both he and they shall be burned with fire, that there will be no immorality in your midst. And that's what God's after. He wants people to honor him and not live, do all these dysfunctional things. If there is a man who lies with an animal, he shall surely be put to death. You shall also kill the animal. If there is a woman who approaches any animal to mate with it, you shall kill the woman and the animal. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood guiltiness is upon them. If there is a man who takes his sister, his father's daughter, or his mother's daughter, so that he sees her nakedness and she sees his nakedness, it is a disgrace. They shall be cut off in the sight of the sons of their people. He has uncovered his sister's nakedness. He bears his guilt. If there is a man who lies with a menstruous woman and uncovers her nakedness, he has laid bare her flow, and she has exposed the flow of her blood. Thus both of them shall be cut off among their people. You shall also not uncover the nakedness of your mother's sister or your father's sister, for such a one has made naked his blood relative. They will bear their guilt. God was very serious about any kind of sexual immorality and obviously incest with sex within a family. If there is a man who lies with his uncle's wife, he has uncovered his uncle's nakedness. They will bear their sin. They will die childless. If there is a man who takes his brother's wife, it is abhorrent. He has uncovered his brother's nakedness. They will be childless. You are therefore to keep all my statutes and all my ordinances and do them, so that the land to which I am bringing you to live will not spew you out. Moreover, you shall not follow the customs of the nations which I drive out before you, for they did all these things, and therefore I have abhorred them. See, God's going to give them the promised land. He doesn't want them to take on the practices of the people of the land because they're doing these things. Hence, I have said to you, you are to possess their land, and I myself will give it to you to possess it, a land flowing with milk and honey. I am the Lord your God, who has separated you from the peoples. Now, that's interesting, right? He separated them from a standpoint of sin, but we heard earlier about aliens who sojourn in Israel. So people could come part of Israel, but they then needed to honor God and follow the same rules. And if not, if they weren't going to honor God and follow the same rules, then they need to be separate because Israel was going to be a theocracy of following God. You are therefore to make a distinction between the clean animal and the unclean, and between the unclean bird and the clean, and you shall not make yourselves detestable by animal or by bird or by anything that creeps on the ground, which I have separated for you as unclean. Back to the food laws, which have largely changed. Thus you are to be holy to me, for I, the Lord, am holy, and I have set you apart from the peoples to be mine. Now a man or a woman who is a medium or a spiritist shall surely be put to death. They shall be stoned with stones. Their blood guiltiness is upon them. Look how God was so stern and clear about worshiping anything other than him. And he would not allow it in his theocracy. So there you have it. You have what Israel was supposed to have was, we're going to worship God and worship him only. And God was their king and Moses was just their leader. Now, eventually, what happened is this. They went in to take over the promised land, but there were other nations around them, and they felt that without an earthly king, that they wouldn't be able to be organized into a government and an army, and they felt that they needed a king, an earthly king, in order to be able to protect themselves from the surroundings. And there makes some sense to that, but yet they were supposed to still be a theocracy that, you know, ultimately who they're following is God. So God allowed, reservedly at first, allowed them to have a king, and they got a wicked king, and that was Saul. And eventually then David became king. But, you know, we saw the problems with, you know, David, even though he was a man after God's own heart, he still, you know, did a lot of sexual sin and even murder and, you know, wasn't perfect by far, but did have a love for God. And then his son Solomon took over, and, you know, it was the highest point of prosperity and peace in Israel, in the promised land. It was an incredible time, but Solomon, who had a lot of wisdom, also, you know, had a huge problem with sexual sin. And eventually, after his problems, his two sons took over and they were wicked, and the Israel split up. So Jeroboam went to the north with 10 tribes. Rehoboam went to the south, including Jerusalem, with 2 tribes. And Israel was never a united country after that. Now they have 2 kings and 2 countries, essentially called Israel and Judah. And eventually, through the waywardness of their kings, they lost their country. The King Nebuchadnezzar came in, and the Babylonian Empire came in, and Israel was no more. They got deported. And Israel was never a country again for a very, 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 very long time, all the way until actually 1948. It wasn't until Israel became a country again. So they lost their country because they did not follow God. They did not honor him, and God allowed it to be taken away. So eventually, God's people were allowed to return from Babylon and rebuild the walls around Jerusalem and rebuild the temple, but it was never their country again until 1948. So they were allowed to come back and worship at the temple, but they were not in charge. They did not have a government. They were just allowed to worship God. And that fast forwarding is the environment that Jesus lived in Jesus's day, that we see in the New Testament. Now, at that time, the Roman Empire had taken over. So Rome is in charge, and what's their government? They have a king, Caesar, and then they have kings and governors who are in charge of certain regions, but they're all appointed by the king. So it's not like we have today. We have in America, we the people, and we elect our government. They didn't have that in Jesus's day. They did not control the government. And really, Jesus lived in a completely different environment. It wasn't a theocracy. Rome wasn't worshiping God. There are a lot of people who are worshiping different gods, but Jesus is turning people to God and ultimately unveiling the New Testament Christianity, which the apostles then developed with the church. And we have now the Christian church, which at first was considered illegal and was heavily persecuted by the Roman Empire until eventually under Constantine in 300 years after Jesus, that the Roman Empire actually made Christianity a illegal religion in the empire. But in Jesus's day in the Bible, they were not in control. And in fact, we don't even see them seeking to take control. Jesus didn't really focus on government because it didn't even seem realistic at that time, because it wasn't like you could win your government through election of Christian people and then you would, you know. Now, eventually, Christianity, because of its influence, essentially did kind of take over government in the Roman Empire. But, you know, Constantine didn't have it all right, but he did make Christianity legal. Well, at that time, you know, the Catholic Church was a major force on the earth after Constantine. And what you have then is still a government that's not a theocracy. You have an independent government of kings, but you have, you know, the Catholic Church having some influence on the government through the, through the Middle Ages. So that kind of gives you a history. And you know, so what we see in Israel with a theocracy is not the government that Jesus lived under. I wonder sometimes, what if America's government was what Jesus lived under? What would the instructions of the Bible be today if they had a government that where they elected their officials and where it was we the people, and yeah, you voted people in? I think Jesus would have still been focused on the church, but if you had a choice to vote in Christians into government, his ways into government, I think he would want to. Why would you, you know, if you're choosing for God, why would you not choose something that honored him versus something that doesn't honor him? So, you know, that's just something interesting to think about as we review the Bible. Now, what I want to do is talk to you about America. So America was formed from people who left England because England was Christian, but it was Anglican, and it was the king who was in charge, so they had a king. He was forcing people to follow a government-run church, and people did not want to have a government-run church because they didn't believe that the government was running the church rightly and teaching the Bible correctly. And as a result of being forced to follow the government's church when they didn't feel it was proper what the government's church was teaching, they wanted to be free. So a group of people inspired for freedom to worship God came to America, and that's what you see in the Mayflower Compact, you know, the first document that they made on board that ship before they, you know, kind of set foot in America, was they really wanted to have a Christian influence in America and be able to worship God rightly. So eventually America then was formed, you know, whatever, 150 years later. So what was going on in America at the time that America was formed? Well, there was a strong, strong sense that they did not want to have a government-led church. They fled that. So they're like, we don't want that. We don't want the government to be in charge of the church. People need to be free to worship God. So that's how America was founded. And I believe that there's some really good principles that America was founded on. However, I think something's been lost, and perhaps even their great fear to have anything established that would force religion on people, prevented them from incorporating into our documents the way that I would prefer, honestly. They have references to God, but it's very vague. Now, what I want you to see, you know, is that I want to read to you some things. So I have a book in front of me. This is by David Barton. It's called The American Story. And when our Constitution was made, there's things in there like God's divine providence and things of that nature. Because the people were largely Christian that formed this country, and they very much valued the Bible, and they very much valued Christian principles, and they very much wanted religion to still be part of government. However, they knew that they couldn't force religion because of what they learned in England. So therefore, morality didn't get woven into our Constitution. They didn't say, well, these are the morals that we're going to live by. They just made sure that you had in the Bill of Rights a freedom of speech. And we'll look at that, and a freedom of religion. We'll look at that in a moment. But I don't think they anticipated. See, America's an experiment. Think about this for a moment. You know, Israel was, you know, kind of an experiment by God, right? I'm going to flee you out of Egypt. I'm going to form your government of a theocracy in the desert, and now you're going to go and take in the promised land. Follow me. Let's see how you do. Well, you know, it didn't work out very well. Like, the people didn't follow God very well. It got divided, you know, around 1000 AD. So, you know, they're divided into two countries, and then around 600, 1000 BC is when the country divided. Solomon's kids took over and divided it around then. And then around 600-ish BC is when they got deported. I mean, where they lost their country. So it was an experiment, and the people didn't do a real good job of following God. What I want you to know is that America's an experiment. We're only 1776, right? The founding of America. And here we are. We're not even 300 years into America. We're only 250 years in. So, like, just like Israel, you know, fell apart, we can fall apart too. And I think it's for the same reasons. That's what I'm trying to share with you, is that Israel forsook God and did not follow his ways, and they lost their country. And we in our country are forsaking God, and we can very much lose this country. There's no surety that America is going to be around in 100 years the way that it is today. Who knows? It may not be, especially with all the division. And what's the division about? We don't have a moral standard. We've lost our moral rudder. We don't have an agreement on what America is anymore. And what I want to share with you is that, okay, listen to some of these quotes. Patrick Henry, the governor of Virginia, way back in the beginning: the great pillars of all government and of social life are virtue, morality, and religion. This is the armor, my friend, and this alone that renders us invincible. He felt that the government and the people of the land really needed to be religious people. John Hancock, signer of the Declaration: sensible of the importance of Christian piety and virtue to the order and happiness of a state, I cannot but earnestly commend to you every measure of their support and encouragement. Meaning, this John Hancock, one of the signers, said that the Christian piety and virtue is so important. Abraham Baldwin, signer of the Constitution: it should therefore be among the first objects of those who wish well to the national prosperity to encourage and support the principles of religion and morality. William Patterson, signer of the Constitution: religion and morality are necessary to good government, good order, and good laws. Governor Morris, signer of the Constitution: I believe that religion is the only solid base of morals, and the morals are the only possible support of free government. Charles Carroll, a Catholic, one of the only Catholic — by the way, Catholicism was not big in America at this time. Through immigration in the 1800s, Catholicism became big in America, but it wasn't. There was only one guy who was Catholic who signed the the Constitution. It's this guy, Charles Carroll. Without morals, a republic cannot subsist any length of time. They therefore, who are decrying the Christian religion, are undermining, those who are like talking against Christianity, are undermining the solid foundation of morals, the best security of the duration of free governments. The best security of the duration of free governments is morals through the Christian religion. Benjamin Rush, the signer of the Declaration, without religion there can be no virtue, and without virtue there can be no liberty, and liberty is the object and life of all republican governments. I mean, I could go on, quote after quote after quote, about how the founding people really felt that the morality of the Bible was important to America. Now, unfortunately, and this is what I find a real frustration, is that because of where they came from, because they came from England, where government was controlling the religion, and they did not want that because they saw the dangers of government controlling religion, they referenced God as a divine power, and they referenced God's divine providence, but they did not put in our Constitution that we're going to tie morality to the Bible. They assumed it. You know, for years, the Bible was the main textbook in the schools. I mean, we're talking all the way until like the late 1800s. So you're talking like the first 100 years of our country. The Bible was the main textbook for school children. But unfortunately, when people began to challenge the ties of the Christian religion to America, you can go back to our founding documents and say, you know what? It doesn't actually say that we have to take our moral principles from the Bible. And I think, to me, that was a mistake. And when I say an experiment, I'm not so sure this experiment's going to work, because I think we have an atheistic, liberal country that now less and less people are basing their morality on biblical morality. And you say, what is America? You know, I think it's so funny when I hear politicians talk and they talk about, well, these are the founding things of America, or this is what America's about. I don't even know what they're talking about anymore. Like, I know what I mean. I mean, I think America's based on a Christian moral background, and that the founding people were largely Christian, and that should be our moral standard. We should have more biblical principles in our country. But the problem is if I want to prove that, I can read to you what the founding people thought. But unfortunately, it's not in our Constitution. So as a result of it not being in our Constitution, that we're going to base our morality on biblical morality. Now, do I think we should force everyone in our country to be Christian? No, I don't. I think they did learn something by having the government force religion. But I wish they would have just said, listen, we're not going to force you to be Christian. We're not going to force you to follow Jesus. We don't think we can do that. However, we're going to say that at least the moral compass of our world, what we're going to base our morals on, is a biblical morality. And I wish they would have did that. They would have said, well, listen, you don't have to worship God, but we are still going to base what morality is based on biblical principles. They assumed it, but they didn't put it in our Constitution. Now, with that said, I want to share with you that there are some good things that America did, and that we have to still, we need to know these things, and it's really important. So the first thing I want to read to you is the First Amendment. So when the Constitution was drafted, they said, listen, don't worry, we're going to follow up immediately with a Bill of Rights. And they did. Within a couple of years, they signed a Bill of Rights, and the very first amendment to the Bill of Rights, which is part of the Constitution, was this one. The very first one, so obviously they thought it was important. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. This is a massively significant amendment that we are free to worship God how we choose, and that we have the freedom to express our faith, and we have the freedom of speech in America. And it's being attacked, it's being assaulted today, but it is woven into our Constitution, and praise God that it is. Now it doesn't govern morality. It doesn't say that we're going to base our country based on a biblical morality, even though you're free to worship, you know, who you want to worship. We're still going to have the basis. No, it doesn't say what I wish we would have had part of our Constitution, but we are free to worship God, and we should use that freedom to worship Him. And, you know, because we have a republic that we can vote people into office, you know, I believe as Christians, we should be seeking to have our government represent more Christian values, just like our founders did. And we should do that, but you know, it's been slipping. We'll see. I hesitate to say there's some resurgence in Christian conservative principles. You know, it's hard to say. You know, we'll see at this next election if it sways. But the overwhelming trajectory is negative, is liberal, is atheistic, and is against the morality of God. That's the trend that we've been on for a very, very long time. For 150 years, we've been sliding away from Christian principles, and it's just getting worse and worse. And I'm not long-term optimistic about where it's headed. However, we do have a big God, and you know what? May the church rise up, and may the church, you know, follow God rightly, and may the church, you know, vote to have Christian principles elevated in our land, because it is we, the people in America. So, you know, God may have another revival in store before His return. That would be awesome. I'd love to be a part of it. And so I don't want to lose hope that that can't happen, but I'm just being, you know, realistic about what the trend has been in America. But we, the church, should be seeking to honor God regardless of what our government does. And we should be seeking to grow our churches and grow Christianity and have an authentic biblical morality represented in our churches. Hallelujah. Now, there's one other thing that I want to touch on, because I think if you don't stand courageously for the freedom of speech, you're going to lose it. And that's what's happening in America today. We've become weak and we've become soft, and we let our companies and we let our government scare us into keeping our mouth shut. And I'm talking about even really good, solid Christians. They cave to their employer, and they keep their mouth shut. And I really need to say something to you all. It's really important. And what I'm going to talk to you right now about, and I'm going to read this to you, what you should know, workplace or religious accommodation. This is part of our governmental laws. And I'm going to give you a summary of what the law of workplace religious accommodation is, because you need to know it, and you need to remind your employers of it when you're persecuted. And this is really important. And this is from the U.S. Listen, I am on an official United States government website, the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission website, and I'm going to read to you what it says. Okay. Our employers require to accommodate the religious beliefs and practices of applicants and employees. Yes. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 prohibits employment discrimination based on religion. This includes refusing to accommodate an employee's sincerely held religious beliefs or practices unless the accommodation would impose an undue hardship more than a minimal burden on operation of the business. A religious practice may be sincerely held by an individual even if newly adopted, not consistently observed, or different from the commonly followed tenets of the individual's religion. So if your sincerely held religious beliefs, even if you haven't held it for a long time, if it doesn't impose if it only imposes a minimal burden, then they have to allow you to have to do that. And I'm going to give you some examples from this U.S. website in a second. What does Title VII mean by religion? Title VII defines religion very broadly. It includes traditional organized religions such as Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism. It also includes religious beliefs that are new, uncommon, not part of formal church or sect, or only held by a small number of people. And that, that's what we have in America because we have a freedom of religion. Religion's pretty loosely defined. Some practices are religious for one person, but not religious for another person, such as not working on a Saturday or Sunday. One person may not work on Saturday for religious reasons. Another person may not work on Sunday for family reasons. Under Title VII, a practice is religious if the employee's reason for the practice is religious. Social, political, or economic philosophies or personal preferences are not religious beliefs under Title VII. What are some common religious accommodations sought in the workplace? Applicants and employees may obtain exceptions to rules or practices in order to follow their religious beliefs or practices. Remember that employees may grant these accommodations for religious reasons, but still refuse to grant them for secular reasons. Examples of common religious accommodations include, now listen, this is important. Listen to these. This is right from our government website. An employee needs an exception to the company's dress and grooming code for a religious practice. Example, a Pentecostal Christian woman who does not wear pants or short skirts, a Muslim woman who wears a religious headscarf, or a Jewish man who wears a skull cap. The EEOC has developed a technical assistance document, Religious Garb and Grooming in the Workplace, Rights and Responsibilities, along with a fact sheet explaining these issues due to the frequency of their occurrence. So you might have certain things you want to wear and you need to be allowed to wear those. Okay, here's another example. A Catholic employee needs to schedule change so that he can attend church services on Good Friday. So if you want to attend, now listen, they used Catholic as an example. Obviously, this could be Christian. So if you want to attend a Good Friday service, you're supposed to be religiously accommodated to attend that Good Friday service. And really, they have to do it as long as it doesn't impose an undue hardship on the company. An atheist needs to be excused from the religious invocation offered at the beginning of staff meetings. Now, listen to that. It's saying that there could be a staff meeting where you would do a religious invocation. And if an atheist wants to be excused from that, they can be excused. But what that's saying, there's actually the freedom in the workplace to do a religious invocation at the beginning of the workday. It's just that if someone doesn't want to take part of it, they can't be forced to. But you can actually do that. Excuse me. A Christian pharmacy employee needs to be excused from filling birth control prescriptions. Or a Jehovah's Witness seeks to change job tasks at a factory so that he will not have to work on producing war weapons. These are just examples. An adherent to Native American spiritual beliefs needs unpaid leave to attend a ritual ceremony, or a Muslim employee needs a break schedule that will permit daily prayers at described times. Listen to that. A Muslim employee needs a break so that he can do daily prayers at prescribed times. An employee needs accommodation for a religious belief that working on a Sabbath is prohibited. This is incredible stuff, right? And the reason I'm taking this time to go over all this is because if we don't exercise our rights, we're going to lose them. And unfortunately, here's the problem. We're so uninformed and uneducated about what our rights are in the freedom of speech in America. We've allowed employers to dictate that you can't even open your mouth up in the workplace about religion because you're not allowed to do that. And that's a lie. It's false. And part of our religious responsibility is to be a witness. And as long as we're not imposing an undue hardship, we are free to speak about our faith anywhere at any time. Now, let's say someone's offended by it. They have I'm maybe getting ahead of myself here because I don't know all the laws, but I think you need to respect that. So if someone in a workplace were to say, listen, I don't want to hear it, I think it's right to say, okay, you tried, and you need to respect them, and, you know, no longer, if they're offended by it, witness to them. But that doesn't mean that you can't talk to someone else about Christianity in the workplace. So we are free, and sadly, we cave. And, you know, I'll close with this. When I was called into ministry, I was in the real estate business, and I had developed an office for the company. I had agreed to turn a team of agents that worked for me over to the company, and also agreed to work as the company's manager for a year and grow their real estate business before I went into ministry, and then someone would be hired to take over my position. And it all worked really well, and someone did come in to take over my position. I actually owned the building, and the company was going to be renting the building from me. But anyways, I said when I was just leading this office and hiring agents, I said, hey, listen, I'm going to do a Bible study. And this is 2003. So we're talking a long time ago. And I'm going to do a Bible study in the morning. Anyone who wants to come can come. So I said that, and it wasn't long after I mentioned that I get called into the office, corporate office, and meet with, you know, like the vice president of the company. And they said, you know, we'd really like you to not do that because someone complained. And, you know, I was on my way out, and I just said, all right, fine, you know, I won't do it. And that's the kind of stuff that I wish I would have been educated. And I should have said, no, we have a right in America to have a freedom of speech. I'm not forcing anyone to come. I'm not making them come. I'm not being biased towards anyone in any way as far as their business. If they want to come, they can come. If they don't want to come, they don't want to come. And I should have held my guns and still did the Bible study. And I wish I would have, and I didn't. And, you know, I have other examples, and I don't want to, you know, take up too much time right now. But the point is, we've been forced into silence in church and people of God. You know, we're losing America, and we should have had more moral principles woven into our Constitution, in my view. But we do need to at least stand with what we've got. And we have the freedom of America, and we have to speak about religious things. We have the freedom of speech, and we even have religious accommodation in the workplace. Become more educated. And when you're persecuted for it, give them the website link and have them read, because they're uneducated. That your employers, they don't even know. And if they know, and you put them on notice that they know, they're going to have a hard time enforcing it. And if so, we need to stand up, and frankly, we need to hold on to our rights. And there are organizations out there that will back us. I'm not saying you won't be persecuted or you won't be fired, but we need more people to take a stand and be courageous and fight for our rights, or we're going to lose them. So thank you for listening, and God bless you all.